So there was one thing that used to always put me in a really bad mood before church. And that one thing that put me in a bad mood was actually a good thing. It was On Being by Krista Tippett. Because her gorgeous radio show would come on the air on Sunday mornings, and I had to listen to some irritatingly profound excerpt while I was driving to church, knowing that a bunch of you were also listening to it, and that you would be filing into your seats here momentarily, and I would just imagine you all thinking to yourselves, I should have just stayed in my car because that was way more interesting than this sermon. In a proverbial instance of being careful what you wish for, though, On Being is no longer on the air on Sunday mornings. It is, unfortunately, living on as a podcast, so it still exists and you can still partake of it. But selfishly, I'm glad that you're not listening to it on the way to church anymore. And in fact, I was looking at the site this morning, and there's a really lovely series they have right now for 6 weeks in the summer on, they're calling it a hope portal, drawing on wisdom from seven of the guests that they've had over the years. And there's even sort of a printout that you can, something you can print out with prompts for journaling or conversations with others. So they're still putting out lovely things, and I encourage you to take a look at that. But after setting aside my grumblings and insecurities, I have come to see that comparing the two Sunday morning offerings of a local pastor's sermon to their church and a nationally syndicated airing of On Being are actually perhaps a helpful example of the different kinds of religious literature that we have in our Bibles already. As I was saying in the children's time, this one book is actually a library. There are books of history, of law, wisdom, poetry, basically a hymnal with the lyrics, books of prophecy, biography, the letters, and even apocalyptic literature like Revelation at the end. And I think many of us have preferences as readers for the kind of lit that we're into. And we also have different gifts and preferences as writers or communicators ourselves. And also the things that we care about that might mean that the ways that we communicate with one another in church or the kinds of sharing we do might fall into some of those categories more than others. If you think even on Sunday morning, some people are never going to want to give a sermon, but they will happily share about their lives. Or some people don't want to share about their lives, but they'll tell you something that's going on that they would invite you to join in with and do with them in the announcement time. Or some folks will share music. Thank you, Larry, and our many musicians. So there are many, many ways that we can share with one another. And sometimes the things we talk about are very specific to our community, to our congregation, and sometimes they're community-specific, and sometimes they're world-specific. And I know that for myself, I just was not able to pivot on a sermon this morning, even though I've been completely preoccupied with the news of our bombings in Iran. So appreciate your prayer this morning, Ron, and that's very much on my heart as well. But for me, I think it's fair to say that the epistles, the letters in the Bible, have never been my go-to. When I choose something to preach on or a scripture to read, I don't tend to go to the epistles, which is actually one of the reasons why we'll be focusing on them this summer, because if I think about sort of the gaps in things that I may have caused by being the primary preacher here over the years, we have not really looked at those books, and they're important and interesting and worth that look. So this summer will be not every single Sunday, because the Sundays will be peppered with other things that will be themes, but probably about six of the Sundays we'll be looking at epistles in one way or the other. And these letters were written in the decades after Jesus' life. Probably, at least the versions that we have, were written before the Gospels, which is also always kind of interesting to think about. Clearly, those Gospel stories were being shared over that time, but as books, the epistles are actually the oldest, older than the Gospels, as far as the books in the New Testament. And many of them were attributed to Paul, I love that they're called the Pauline letters. Now that I know a Pauline, I always think of Pauline when I talk about the Pauline letters. And there was a while where I was pretty cranky about Paul, so that was actually really helpful to think of them as the Pauline letters instead. But some of the ones that were attributed to Paul probably weren't actually written by Paul, but were written by people in the same school of thought. There's a lot of scholarship about who wrote what, and then what it means about how seriously you take this or that, or how you weigh it, depending on who might have written it or not. And then there are also books by John, Peter, James, many other letters there as well. I'm just going to read a little bit from the New Interpreter's Bible commentary, just because I thought it was a little interesting background on the epistles. The letters all share a common purpose, to combine theological instruction and moral exhortation toward particular practical and pastoral ends. Each addresses the spiritual struggles and theological controversies that face ordinary believers seeking a more mature witness to their faith in Jesus Christ, often within hostile social settings. Each reflects its own particular historical occasion and theological situation where the gospel of God is adapted to the life of God's people. Each is deeply rooted in particular interpretive traditions that were judged acceptable by the early church and therefore included in the canon. The commentator goes on to say, none of these letters began its life as a biblical writing read by the whole church for theological understanding. Every letter was at first a pastor-teacher's written response to believers whose particular circumstances provoked a spiritual crisis that required theological explanation and practical resolution. The letters of the New Testament are occasional literature then. That is, in every case, writers adapted their core theological convictions to a particular audience's historical situation in ways that enabled their writing to be, in one writer's phrase, a word on target. So that's a little bit about the epistles generally. And he goes on to say that these texts can be considered kind of a window through which the ancient author and first readers can be more clearly viewed by us from the distance of time. So if the epistles are windows through which to see the early churches, that view isn't always very flattering. But it makes sense, because as it says here, those letters are often because a crisis has come up. And so they're particularly focusing in sometimes on the issues that might have been uncomfortable or highlighting ways in which maybe the group was struggling to handle it in a mature way. Again, here, this is a little bit of the like Krista Tippett wisdom literature versus like coming in here and having to talk about the particular thing that we're struggling with. One is probably a lot more appealing to sit down and listen to than the other, perhaps. And also, I love that phrase, sort of occasional literature, because I think it is important to also remember there was an occasion that prompted these things, and that, I think, helps us think through how to discern, you know, whether, so do we have a parallel situation here in any way, and so how is this applicable to us? Or maybe we find ourselves at the other end of a spectrum and need to think about that when thinking about these occasional writings. But Well, and also, I think it is interesting to think about the difference between how the churches are portrayed in these letters versus, for example, the book of Acts, which tells some of those stories of the early church in some ways a little bit more of a flattering way. You know, in Acts, they're all gathering together and having all things in common, and, you know, flames of fire and Pentecost and all these wonderful things. And then the letters are kind of like the, well, actually, here's what's going on inside those communities. But those letters were so important in the survival of the early church. The church might not have survived as a whole. It might have fragmented much earlier on and been less cohesive than it even has been. I think the letters serve to try to keep a critical mass of people believing something common enough about the teachings and the life of Jesus to form a movement that would stay together over time. And the letters aren't the same as creeds or mission statements. We don't get to hear the Galatians' core values or vision statement. you don't get to see sort of the pamphlet, you know, that the Colossians made up of, you know, why do they have a parrot in their sanctuary or, you know, something like that. We don't get to hear how they would have described themselves and their hopes for how they would be known in the world and the community. We're reading about each of them through the lens of Paul or whoever was writing to them to say, I'm so grateful you're doing all these good things, and also let's look at this. And so as I was saying in the children's time again, and the reason that I chose the scriptures that I did is because I've always loved the beginnings and the endings, the introductions and the closings to the epistles. They're just so warm and personal, and I love the picture that it gives you that the person writing it, while they couldn't be there in person, their connections, you know, say hello to so-and-so, I'm sending so-and-so, please accept them and give them hospitality. And I wish you the warmest, you know, may you have grace and courage for what you're going through. And there always is, you know, the important, you know, it might sound like buttering up to when you know that you're going to hear examples of the good things you do and you know something else is coming. But hey, that acknowledgement of things that are going well is important. And also, again, I think it shows us that the people writing those letters knew and loved the communities they were writing to. One thing that's clear is that it wasn't clear always who had a right to teach and who had a right to send letters to congregations or churches like this, who had a right to say these things. And so the letters also include a lot of sort of language about, and this is why I'm worthy to send you this. You know, sometimes Paul will say things about being in prison for the sake of the teachings, or sometimes it's references to Jesus, more about Jesus' death and resurrection than specific teachings in the letters. But you can see those signals in the letters where whoever is writing it is saying, you know, you can listen to me. I have authority here. I'm a good person. You can listen to me. Because Paul was not the only teacher writing, as I sort of thinking of it in my brain as the Mediterranean circuit, if you think about kind of the circuit riders in America. There were other communities and other letters that didn't make it into the canon, too, and we don't always know the stories behind those. One of my favorite aspects of the epistles are those greetings and sign-offs, because I think it's important to signal that that knowledge and connection too. Because I think many I think of the recent example of a bunch of churches in October downtown got anonymous leaflets on their windshields during the Sunday service. Well, those were letters that had some suggestions for things that the church could do differently, but that's very different when it's something anonymous and it's not a, I am part of you, I am part of us, and I'm concerned about this. So that indication of connection and being in community together, I think is very important in those letters. And again, we'll be looking at some of these more this summer. And it has made me curious to think about other letters throughout Christian history and even currently. A lot of the writings I have in compilations of Anabaptist history and theologians, we know some of that what they thought because they wrote letters to each other that were similar in tone to the epistles in some ways. Anabaptists have never lacked for being opinionated about how each other should be interpreting things and doing things. And although Anabaptists weren't always historically folks to sort of write that down in a systematic theological way, we know what they were thinking because of those letters that they shared with one another. And jumping hundreds of years ahead, I think of Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter to a Birmingham jail, which was part of a correspondence. He was, at the beginning of it, he says he's responding to, I think, a communication from 8 clergy people, and in response he writes this letter, letter to a Birmingham jail, which was the sort of subtitle of it in the Christian Century, was a vigorous, eloquent reply to a criticism expressed by a group of 8 clergymen. So, when I send the sermon manuscript, I'll send links to some of these letters that I'm mentioning. I'm sure you know the letter to a Birmingham jail. But I personally remember reading in 1993, which would have been the year I was heading to college at Eastern Mennonite University, where I would soon find myself declaring a Bible major, that the publication that was, I don't know if it was called the Mennonite then or the Gospel Herald, called The Spiritual Poverty of the Anabaptist Vision, was published by Steve Dinneman, who is the brother of Pam, who was a pastor here for a while, and he was on faculty there at EMU at the time. And that was, Mennonite has come out biweekly or monthly for years and years and years, and there's always really interesting things, but it's not that often that I've noticed that something in there like gets picked up and is really talked about like that, and this letter is an example of that. I think he was reflecting on the Anabaptist vision, which was something that was written decades before that, and he was saying, I think as a church we need to think about the effect that that's had on us, and it's been good, but maybe there are other things to think about. And that's one time where I feel like I've gotten to see sort of live in action a letter to the church become a conversation that I thought was really interesting and at the time. In 2017, John Pavlovitz, who some folks might follow online, wrote a public letter to the Evangelical Church, which spurred conversation. And in 2020, surprise, surprise, it became more common for writers and pastors, I think, to turn to letter writing. Like, for example, Richard Rohr, whom many of us, I think, read, began writing occasional letters that he called letters from outside the camp. And you could say that much of his writing, in a way, is letters, but he was more specific about framing it that way, referring to the many usages of outside the camp in the Hebrew Bible. And Rohr was suggesting that such a position can support those who want to move beyond the contemporary political and religious encampments of our day. Around the same time, the Lutheran pastor and public speaker Nadia Bolz Weber wrote a pastoral letter for such a time as this, which was addressed primarily to fellow white Americans. Skipping forward to this year or the past year or two, I think of groups like Mennonite Action, who in some ways have been functioning as epistle writers in their call to the church, to the Mennonite church, to say, you know, we are in this community with you, and we think we should be looking at some of these ways to be active in the world. I think that's an outgrowth of this sort of epistle tradition. And I think of the letter writing that many folks are more engaged in now, I think in the last 8 years, 8, 10 years, more letters to legislators, things like that, which in themselves aren't epistles, but oftentimes they're published as open letters to, or letters in religious publications or local publications. That tradition of the letter to the editor or the open letter, those are ways of saying, you know, I'm a part of this community, and I think we should be thinking about some of these things. So it's a live tradition. And I think what's interesting about the epistles here is how and when does an occasional letter become something that you hold on to and that you continue to hold up as something to discern over time. And even once it ends up in here, as always, it's our job to do that work of discernment and to say, we have a right to look at that as believers and say, how did that end up here? And not to just take things without question, but to look at the questions and ask if they are questions applicable for our time and place. And I feel like I have to also acknowledge that while I have seen letters prompt healing, letters, not just ones that are put on windshields, but letters can prompt pain, depending on the spirit that they're written in. And even if they're written in a spirit of love, I think many of us probably have examples of letters that we've received or a loved one has received that were really difficult. So again, like all scriptural discernment, you know, remembering that these are occasional things, and not all letters make the canon, whether they're personal letters for ourselves or letters for the church. Not all critiques are correct, and also not all compliments are correct. And I think it's our responsibility to look at both of those things whenever someone takes the time to send a letter our way. The responsibility of accepting or rejecting is a responsibility. And in our tradition, we believe in doing that together in one another's company. I personally think one important aspect of a good epistle, one that would make the cut for my own canon, would be a letter written to a community that includes yourself, or a letter written to a community that you're in relationship with in some way, that it's written within a community you feel is a beloved community in some way, or that you have been a part of and desire to have it flourish as a beloved community, that a good epistle, quote-unquote good, is not just a letter written to someone else pointing out their flaws. It's an us letter. It's an I'm a part of this, and this is what I see, and I will be, some of this lands on me, and I will be a part of whatever happens to make a change as well. That we don't just get to sort of send epistles as arrows out to some other camp, hoping they hit hard and we get some satisfaction about that. The us, them, in the good sense of the word, to have an epistle be to a community that you feel you have been an us, or you are an us in that community. And I think it would be interesting to hear what words all of us here might have, What would you put in a letter to the churches of Lancaster County or the churches of the United States or Community Mennonite? One of the things I look forward to doing some more reading about is, like, I, for example, don't feel like I have a really good sense of a letter to the Galatians, like, how big were the churches in Galatia? Is that sort of like Lancaster County churches? Is it more like one big congregation? I have my own reading to do on the epistles and look forward to bringing some more of that in. And I was thinking, too, about our practice of writing this I Believe statements in November, and if anybody would feel called to make their this I Believe letter to the church in some way, that could be an interesting practice to hear what folks might have to say. And if there's a particular epistle or passage in the epistles that you would have interest in, I'd welcome hearing that as we sort of decide which ones to focus on. I'm definitely going to be doing a little preaching on Galatians, partly because it was in the narrative lectionary earlier this summer, and my uncle wrote the Believer's Bible Commentary Series commentary on Galatians, and so it's given me an excuse to reach out to him and say, hey, would you talk with me about, you know, why did you choose to give a chunk of your life and scholarly work to this particular book, and what do you think the epistles have to say to the church? And he was someone who was involved, for example, in the writing of the Confession of Faith in a Mennonite Perspective, and has cared about our denomination a lot over the years. So that's one reason I'm thinking of doing some preaching on Galatians, but would be really pleased to hear if there are other specific books that are of interest. So send those our way. Finally, I was just going to close with one thing that, I don't know, it's an epistle in that it's a song that I wrote, and I've shared it with you all before, but it's in the form of a letter. And when I was writing it, I was thinking about sort of the voice of the letter would be a little bit more to the younger ones, to children in a way, although it kind of turned into something not just for children. But it's actually sort of about wishing you could write things in a letter. Some years ago, when it felt a little less problematic to love the Harry Potter books, which have all their things this way and that, but my kids and the people that would have been children when I was first a pastor, I read those books so that I would have something to talk to them about, because when I was first starting out as a pastor, I wanted to get to know the kids, and so I read what they were reading. And in the Harry Potter books, there's this tradition of you find out that you're special by getting this letter that shows up. And so the song isn't about that, but that was sort of the mental picture that I had at the time, is sort of all these kids in the U.S. sort of, well, other places, but sitting there having in this imagination, like, would a letter arrive for them, and what would it say? So, I wrote this for a church service here, one of the Sundays where we tapped a few songwriters and said, here's the scripture for this Sunday. Does anybody want to take a crack at a song? And this was my crack at it. It was from the Sermon on the Mount, the passage about letting your light shine and not putting it under a bushel. My mouth is really dry, so we'll see what I can do. Oh, I wish I could tell you, my darling, that a letter will arrive by post with a signed invitation telling you all you're supposed to know. But it's much harder, my darling, but also easier by far, for you're already shining brightly as a morning star. Wherever you are is the lampstand. So shine, shine, shine. Come out from under the covers, oh, beloved, beloved of mine. Wherever you are is the lampstand. So shine, shine, shine. Come out from under the covers, oh, beloved, beloved of mine. More than 13 billion years ago, love said, let there be light. So light came into being, and love said, saw that it was right and good. So today love is asking you, my darling, yes, now in the darkest night, to join the constellations and let your light shine bright. For this is not a time for biting, little light. Come out from come out from hiding. This is not a time for biting, little light. Come out from hiding. Wherever you are is the lampstand. So shine, shine, shine. Come out from under the covers, oh, beloved, beloved of mine. Wherever you are is the lampstand. So shine, shine, shine. Come out from under the covers, oh, beloved, beloved of mine.